Hey, welcome back to the Deep Focus Podcast, part of the Playlist Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rodrigo Perez. I'm also the editor-in-chief of theplaylist.net. I hope you're reading, I hope you're listening, I hope you're doing well, and, you know, keeping safe now that the pandemic hellscape seems to be subsiding. Hopefully you've been vaccinated by now, and or at least, you know, you're waiting your turn so you can do that and re-enter society safely. Maybe you've even been to a few movies and theaters now. Wouldn't that be a nice change, right? Well, speaking of, we got a good one this week, something that's going to be in theaters that you should definitely see. This week in my semi-regularly scheduled podcast, again, it's Deep Focus, my guests are filmmaker Edgar Wright and the members of Sparks. What a treat for me. You know, Wright, Edgar Wright probably doesn't need much introduction. He's the director of the Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and more. You know, Wright is one of the most dynamic filmmakers in the world, and he has two films coming out this year. One is the psychodrama Last Night in Soho, coming out in September. But the one we're going to talk about today is the upcoming The Sparks Brothers documentary, which opens in theaters Friday, June 18th. Now, Sparks and the Sparks Brothers might need a little bit more teeing up than usual for maybe most or some movie audiences, but let me tell you that the documentary is outstanding, and it just like pulsates with the same energetic energy of Wright's narrative features. It's actually 2 hours and 22 minutes approximately, but as I joked, as I congratulated to Edgar on you know, making the land speed record for creating the fastest 2 hour plus film that feels like more like 95 minutes, it just whizzes by. So Sparks, who are Sparks? What are they about? You know, that's exactly what Edgar Wright's documentary tackles, because Sparks are not only a band, but they're a fairly elusive and mysterious one to a lot of people, including like music heads and music writers. You know, I was a music writer for years, and I still know a lot of people who just don't know Sparks. They don't know where to start. And that's also part of what Edgar tries to unpack, decode, demystify. You know, they've released 25 albums. They've been around for 5 decades since the early 70s. They were discovered by Todd Rundgren. And at first, they kind of began as a glam rock band that was a little bit like a cross between, you know, like this weird hybrid of maybe T-Rex, Roxy Music, Queen, and maybe even a little bit of David Bowie thrown in there too. Sparks are American, but many assumed for years they were also an English band because they sure sounded like it. Sparks also deeply evolved over the years. In the late 70s, when disco was becoming a thing and their career had kind of plateaued, they began working with the great super producer Giorgio Moroder, who also did a lot of amazing film soundtracks like Paul Schrader's American Gigolo. And, you know, they essentially jump-started British synthwave a few years before it became a thing. And they have influenced a ton of UK bands like the Pet Shop Boys, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Erasure, New Order, and many more, many of whom were in this documentary testifying their praise for Sparks. You know, the documentary is just filled with talking head testimonials from bands and pop culture figures who adore Sparks. Beck, Mike Myers, the comedian, Fred Armisen, members of the Sex Pistols, Duran Duran, the Go-Go's, Jason Schwartzman, Franz Ferdinand, who recorded an entire album with Sparks in the 2000s, Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and like so many more. Basically, if there's a known music head out there, they're likely in the Sparks Brothers documentary, demonstrating their love for this band. As Beck says early on, Sparks were probably your favorite band's favorite band. And the conversation when meeting another band often sort of lands on Sparks. Sparks was massively influential on a ton of bands, but they're not really that well known. And unfortunately, major success mostly eluded them, aside from like early UK success in the 70s and then sporadic scattered pop hits all over the world over the ensuing decades. You know, the documentary, literally, it's superb, and I really can't recommend it enough. It's like Edgar Wright's passionate, energetic, super deluxe mixtape that he is dying to pass on to you so you too can understand and love Sparks too. You can feel the energy of Edgar just dying to share this with you. You know, he's had a massive passion for this band for decades, and he sort of like wants to kind of pay it forward. His infectious enthusiasm for the band can be deeply felt throughout the dynamic documentary, and it's also an ode and tribute to their tenacity, their perseverance, and their ability to ride the waves up in many downs. I think he, beyond being a fan of their band and their music, I think he's also grown to have a genuine love for who they are as artists and everything they stand for. And Sparks are generally, at least on the outside, a weird, eccentric, elusive band. And I think the fact that they played with the ideas of whether they're sincere or not really threw a lot of listeners. People didn't kind of know what to make of them, I think. But honestly, they're brilliant. And Wright's fabulous documentary has really awakened my love for this this band. In fact, I've made a Spark Spotify playlist, and I'm going to make sure to embed that into the web story I write to accompany this conversation. So hopefully, if you don't know much about Sparks and you find this whole conversation intriguing, hopefully you'll want to dig in and learn something about their music. They're really amazing and versatile, eclectic. They're kind of all over the map. I've had 5 decades to just kind of try out every pop style under the sun, and they're super catchy. And so lastly, Sparks are also big cinephiles too, and that's a big part of the documentary. And so in this conversation with them, we touch upon a lot of that. You know, they almost work with Tim Burton on a film in the 90s. They almost work with the legendary French comedic filmmaker Jacques Tati in the 1970s. And they told me a little bit about that project too, which was really cool. They also have a second movie project coming out this year. They wrote the story and the music to Annette, which is Leo Carax's musical starring Marion Cotillard and Adam Driver, and it's the opening night film of Cannes this year. That is also kind of a full circle moment in the documentary that is like really triumphant and really lovely, and I can't impress it enough. It's easily one of the best films of the year, the Sparks Brothers documentary. Okay, so now quickly a brief word from our sponsors before we start. So this episode is brought to you by Secret of the Whales. From executive producer and National Geographic explorer James Cameron comes Secret of the Whales, a Disney Plus original documentary series plunging viewers deep within the epicenter of whale culture to experience the extraordinary communication skills and intricate social structures of 5 different whale species. Narrated by Sigourney Weaver, the series was filmed over 3 years in 24 locations around the world. As the Wall Street Journal said, it takes just a single glance at the opening scene to feel like you've been transported to paradise. Secret of the Whales is for your consideration for Outstanding Documentary or Nonfiction Series, streaming now on Disney Plus, and more information is available at natgeotv.com/FYC for your consideration. Okay, so before we join the conversation with Sparks and Edgar Wright, as always, Deep Focus is part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which includes Be Real, the regular weekly Playlist Podcast, The Fourth Wall, The Discourse, and more. And we can be heard on iTunes, Anchor FM, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Do us a big favor. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and drop us a comment or a rating. You know, we really do appreciate it. And we thank you for listening. Oh, last thing, just for clarification, of course. So Sparks are the brothers Ron and Russell Male. Ron is the musical brains behind the band, and he's got like a lower voice. And Russell is the singer. He's got a higher voice. And that's how you'll know who's speaking in Sparks. It's Ron and Russell. Take note, Edgar joins this conversation a little late because of some Zoom technical difficulties, and Sparks and I just ended up chatting solo, sort of kind of casual for the first few minutes, and then he jumps in, and I think the whole thing's, hopefully enjoy it. I think it's a good conversation. Okay, so here's Edgar and the fabulous Sparks Brothers, and once again, thank you very much for listening.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. Nice to see you.
You too.
I guess we're just waiting on...
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. I got to tell you guys that I love this documentary so much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I've been a Sparks fan, but this has really reignited my Sparks fandom in a major, major way. So,
oh, great. Thank you.
I don't know about you guys, but cinema and music has always been my connection. It's always done that for me. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but like I've come to reappreciate a lot of music through film, something that I thought was something about the cinematic context. And you guys, cinema is such a big thing for you guys too. I wonder if you've ever had that phenomenon.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think even from an early age when I, this is really dating myself, but when I went to see Blackboard Jungle and it had Rock Around the Clock at the start of it, and hearing it on the radio was one thing, but seeing it in a huge movie theater with enormous images, and it meant something different. And I've always really had the desire, just being film buffs as well as loving the music, to want to do a movie musical project, but kind of in our own terms. And we've had, you probably already know the history of our ones that didn't come across, but you know, just at the moment we really feel that that's an area that it doesn't have to be kind of so much of a sideline to what you're doing. It can be all kind of one thing.
For sure. It's just interesting to me because I the cinema and music has always been this, like my site even started out as a sort of a soundtracks and movie music stuff, and then and sort of more from there. But that was always a push and pull my entire life. Was like, am I going to be a band? Am I going to do music, movie stuff? Am I going to back and forth? And I assume that was kind of similar for you guys, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can do music a lot easier with less trappings than to do movies. So I guess in a certain way, we've always thought that we could do our version of a movie just within a 3.5 minute pop song, even that you can be as fanciful and do whatever story you want to tell. And it doesn't cost you any more to tell whatever a cinematic type story, whatever that might be, but within the context of a song, you know. And so in a certain way, you can dream up scenario as if it were a movie, but without having to spend $50 million on an actual movie or to get a budget for $50 million to do a film. Right.
Were you conscious of that from the beginning? Because obviously as time goes on, you can look at Sparks albums as like mini movies or concept albums or whatever you want to call them. But was that your approach to like, this album, you know, like Indiscreet or whatever is our, this kind of movie or something? Was it visually or cinematically, were you thinking of it in those terms, or was it just kind of becoming like that?
It was kind of becoming like that. I mean, it was more that other people were commenting that they felt that the music and the images were somehow cinematic. I mean, not necessarily that it sounds like film music, but just the concept of it being kind of larger than life and really dramatic. So, you know, once people start mentioning that, I guess you become a little bit self-aware of what you're doing. But, you know, we never thought of an album in terms of this is our Magnificent Ambersons or something. It was always more, it sounds very mundane, but working from individual songs. And when that whole group of songs is finished, it kind of takes on, if you're lucky, it takes on greater than the sum of its parts, meaning where it can have kind of a cinematic feel in a very general sense.
In that sense, I'm wondering how much of that, because like you said, there's no kind of cost, but I also think of that like personal cost, like your songs obviously have a lot of characters and there's this witticism that, were you conscious? Did it become like, I can say all this stuff because it's not like, oh, my personal love song or whatever. It's like this story and this character. And, you know, not a lot of musicians do that, like speak through different characters. And did that allow you guys, once you kind of keyed into that or when you became conscious of it, like really allow you to expand the complete possibilities of what you could say or musically or lyrically?
I don't even know if it's that. I mean, Ron does the bulk of the lyric writing, so I'm speaking for him. But, I don't think it's anything that conscious. I think it's just something you have innate within your creative capacity and your desire, and you write song. In certain times, I think it's not being done as a reaction towards how you perceive lyrics being used in other people's songs. But I think it's, you can see the disparity between Sparks lyrics and 90% of pop lyrics, where the lyrics are meant to be more like wallpaper. You know, you're not, it's better if they don't draw attention to themselves. And then you don't have to, the listener doesn't have to take an active part in the process of listening to the song. It's kind of in the background, and that's cool. But I think we never approached songs in that way. They're meant to be listened to. And obviously they're also serving as something that you can groove to in the background as well. But also they're given this a canvas, you know, to be able to make lyrics and songs be something more than just being kind of mundane, cliched things, you know, that if you're dealing with subject matter that's maybe been dealt with before, relationship songs, there's way to do relationship songs that isn't kind of hackneyed. And so I think that that's kind of always been, we don't have a board meeting to discuss that, but it's always sort of a given that just making something interesting, I think, is as opposed to a lot of pop music, which is like either no one wants to push it in the lyrical way or they see it in a different sort of way, where kind of bearing your soul with the breakup you've just had is that's sort of treated as being serious lyrics, even though the lyrics themselves might not be well crafted.
Yeah, and also there is sometimes an assumption that what is being said in our songs is directly our view on things. And that often isn't the case, where it's the character's view. And Russell he's an actor in it and just selling this. And so I guess he's doing a good job of acting, because people sometimes criticize us for a certain view that's expressed in a song or a character's traits, but it isn't always us.
Sorry, I was not allowed in. I was not authorized to join.
Oh, man.
You don't have a visa. That's what you mean.
I was gonna, at one point, I thought I hadn't said it to the guys yet, but I thought maybe I'd just get Ron to play your part. And that might, fit in the whole performative aspect of it all.
Featuring Ron Mayall as Edgar Wright.
Yes.
Did you guys start already without me? Or?
We did. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry, no worries.
So you have like 10 minutes of solo talking now for you.
We've done a bit of a Sparks interview. Now maybe we can do an interview about the Sparks brothers.
good.
But so I guess while you're here, Edgar, I wanted to ask, like, how did you come to Sparks? And then Sparks, Ron and Russell afterwards, how did you come to Edgar, like in through his movies?
So my first experience with Sparks was when I was 5 years old watching Top of the Pops, which was 1979. So it was when Ron and Russell had the number one in Heaven album out and were on Top of the Pops quite a few times in that year. So I just remember, like, before the music, like, it's this, the image of Ron and Russell on the show was very like dynamic and slightly disconcerting, in a way, like, especially when kind of like sandwiched between kind of like happy smiley acts like ABBA and stuff, and then like you've got Ron and Russell staring down the barrel of a camera at you. So that was the sort of, so number one was kind of the image. And then my parents used to buy me and my brother these kind of like chart compilation albums, like these K-Tel albums. And I happened to have one that had Beat the Clock on it. So that was my first Sparks on vinyl. And then the following year I had another like compilation album, this time with When I'm With You on it. And in a sort of pre-internet age, like growing up as a music fan, as I'm sure we all remember, before everybody's entire discography being online for free. before that, like, you, to figure out about a band, you could only go on what you had in front of you, like, which would be what was on the TV and the radio, and then what may or may not be in a local record store, or what may or may not be in a magazine, and what may or may not be in the library. So for a long time, Sparks were a bit of a riddle to me, because they kept coming back into my life. When I was like a teenager, I was listening to a lot of like David Bowie and Roxy Music and Queen, and then I kept hearing Sparks songs on compilations, and I was like, are these the Beat the Clock guys? It's the same voice, but it's a different sound. And then way later in the mid-90s, when Ron and Russell sort of had a comeback single in the UK with When Do I Get to Sing My Way, like, coming back, so, if I don't mind saying so in front of the guys, like, impossibly handsome and sort of like ageless, they're very strange. And I was like, wait, what is happening? This is the same band again, the ones from Beat the Clock. So then, and then, like, to bring it up to the present, I think what had been a riddle to me then had become a full-on obsession. And then I think particularly in the last like 20 years since the release of Little Beethoven, just kind of sort of confounded and so impressed by Sparks' trajectory, like seemingly like completely different to any other band that have been making music for that long. And, this led to me like vocalizing, somebody needs to make a documentary about Sparks. Like, Sparks have had the most amazing career, and like, people really need an overview. I was very aware that people were daunted by the discography. The people that didn't know Sparks say, oh yeah, I want to get into Sparks. Where do I start? So in a way, like, sort of me making the film was an attempt to sort of cut out like 90 minutes of conversation at dinner of me trying to explain Sparks.
Hand over. Here you go. What's Sparks about? You take this, like the mixtape, but it's the movie.
Yes, exactly. It's like the equivalent of me making a Sparks mixtape for somebody is like saying, watch this movie. Come back to me in 2 hours and then you will know everything.
And Ron and Russell, when did you come aware to the films of Edgar?
No, we always, really love the three UK films that, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and World's End, just love those films. We were aware of Edgar from those. And then when we saw Scott Pilgrim, you know, it's like kind of also that same kind of thing, that filling in the blank, that's the same director that did those films, you know, and you kind of go, wow, it's, you know, and it's different, but it's the same kind of equivalent that Edgar was mentioning about, hey, it's the same guys, you know, from, and so Edgar's transported to this film that's like equally striking as those others, but in a kind of different way. And just the sensibility of Scott Pilgrim and just how it's done is just, you know, it's so striking and there, you know, it just seems like there's parallels with kind of stylistically what's going on in that movie and Spark's approach to music and Edgar's sensibility of just, I don't know, not only the story, but the use of music in that film and the kinetic kind of energy that film has. And then, you know, and then obviously then through the Baby Driver and everything. So, you know, we've just been fans of Edgar's work. And so when Edgar had proposed the idea of maybe doing a documentary on the band, we were like sold on the day right then, because we kind of knew if Edgar would just, if it would be an Edgar Wright film and, you know, but transplanted to a documentary on us, then it couldn't go wrong. You know, we were convinced, you know, despite past hesitations to do a documentary, because sometimes you think, oh, a documentary is kind of like the obituary of a band, just those sort of connotations to us of what a documentary might be for a band that's still active and doing work now as much as we are. But when it was Edgar proposing this, it was a completely different proposition to us, which we were, you know, just so excited about.
The other thing that was the final piece of that kind of made it for sure was just that Edgar really felt that he wanted to treat all the periods equally in a creative kind of way, that whatever the realities of the situation are, that there wasn't a decade in with regard to the documentary that would be the golden age. And that was really important to us, just because, you know, we in our own minds at least feel that what we work on always at a current time is something that we feel as passionately about as what we were doing decades ago.
I think that really comes across too. It just feels like a very much of an evolution and an evolution and an evolution. Speaking of that, Edgar, I assume that there's got to be, well, first of all, like, you know, congratulations on, I think, making the land speed record for the fastest 2 hour and 2 minute, 20 minute movie I think I've ever seen. Like, it's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, but actually goes by in about 90. So that's pretty fantastic. So was there a much longer version? Are you going to have like a DVD with like all this other stuff?
Yeah, I think it's like probably been already misreported that there's a longer cut that might be.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, there is, but like the thing is, as you can imagine, it was already like a Herculean task by the archive producers and the producers of the film to kind of like just clear everything that's in the documentary. So there won't be a longer cut on Blu-ray, but there is a lot of supplemental stuff. So we're just working on that at the moment. So you won't be able to see like a longer version, but you will be able to see some other interviews that we did that were really fun and didn't really fit into it. Sort of very quickly, the kind of the momentum of the piece started to dictate the way that it was going to be. So then we did some great on location stuff with Ron Russell. It's really sweet, but sort of didn't fit into the pell mell through the discography and stuff. So what's great is all that stuff exists and that will all be on the Blu-ray. But I mean, I think it was trying to kind of get the length of it right was a tricky one, because I wanted to be really comprehensive and I didn't want to skip a period, because I didn't want any periods, like Ron said, I didn't want any periods to feel lesser. And in a weird way with Sparks, unlike a lot of other bands, the misses are as important or as interesting as the hits. You know, the kind of the peaks and troughs is important to the whole story. Like I'm sure there's a lot of music documentaries where if there's an album that's a flop, they might just skip over that one. Or like the Bee Gees documentary completely skips over Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is like, oh, I want to hear about that bit. I really like the documentary. Don't get me wrong, I thought it was great, but it was like, oh, I want to see that 15 minutes that's on the cutting room floor about that film. But in this, I felt like the truth of it is, and I think one of the lessons of the film, like success in a way is like sort of being proud of your successes as well as your failures, you know, because Ron and Russell have done everything on their own terms. It's quite unusual that they have a back catalogue where it's just aging beautifully. And when you see them on tour, like now, like there's no like songs that are like embarrassing to sing. If anything, I think Russell is aging into some of the songs even better when they were first recorded. So with that in mind, it just felt like the film had to be comprehensive. If anything, actually, there was one cut that I did which was a bit shorter. It was basically the same movie, but a bit shorter. And I showed it to Phil Lord. I swear to God that Phil Lord doesn't get paid every time I mention him in an interview, but he's a good friend of mine. But he said, I love the documentary. He goes, if I had one note, it's like, could you just open up the songs a little bit? Because it'd be great to hear a bit more of them. And I said, oh, you're preaching to the choir. I would love to do that. Because I do feel like the film has to be a celebration, but also an introduction. And there are quite a few music documentaries, not mentioning any names, which whilst they're really good, they don't give you any breath to enjoy the song if you're hearing it for the first time. And so in that way, it becomes a bit exclusive. It's like, it's great if you're already a fan, but if you're watching the documentary to become a fan, the documentary doesn't give you time to soak in these songs. And that's not a problem with a Beatles documentary. You don't have to stop and explain what Strawberry Fields is. But the great thing here, and covering like 25 albums, is like sort of talk about the songs, hear some of the songs. So it's still shorter than the Billie Eilish documentary, and she's 18, so I think it's okay.
That's true.
It's also it's the same length as Cruella out in cinemas this week, which is also like we're fine, we're good.
That's another great point. Does Ron and Russell, obviously when you see it, you must have a reaction, but tell me about when you guys saw it, how you felt, and do you have a favorite moment or favorite scene that you particularly like? Like I, for example, get a huge laugh out of every time the Sex Pistol calls Russell a cutie pie. It's a very particular thing that just cracks me up.
Steve Jones, he's got away with words for sure. No, when the first time we saw it, because Edgar had waited a long time, because I think we hoping that we could all watch it together for the very first time, you know, because, you know, it's been almost maybe 3 years of work went into this. And so, you know, just to kind of go, here's a link, have fun. You know, it's kind of very unceremonial after, you know, everything that Edgar put into this film and all the people that helped with it. And then I think we're all kind of waiting, okay, is the pandemic going to get over soon? Pandemic's over soon. And then it kind of was apparent that that wasn't going to happen. So semi-reluctantly, Edgar, you know, gave us a link to see it at one point. And we watched it separately. Ron watched it his place and I watched it mine. And, you know, we were waiting for one to call the other because we knew we were watching it at the same time. And, you know, you didn't know if the other had ended his and you didn't want to call in the middle of the thing, but both just had the same reaction. You know, we're just blown away at, you know, stylistically that it, you know, how the whole film was put together and that it contained this emotional side to the whole story that we, being so close to it, we would never in a million years dream that could be achieved in a documentary about Sparks. As we would always, I mean, semi-jokingly say to Ed, you know, I don't know, things like, you know, we hope there's do we have an angle kind of Sparks? Because we thought the documentaries that have the automatic dramatic elements of the drug abuse and overcoming that, and then go, ah, oh, that's so great. They overcame it and now they're back and the career nosedive. And then that was it. And then it became tragic and look at them now. But we kind of don't fit into any of those sort of categories. And so we always perceived ourselves as like, well, but is there anything interesting about our story other than we have a lot of albums, you know? But Edgar did an amazing job to kind of bring out this stuff that we ourselves didn't even see. And equally important was just, we always said, God, we hope this looks like an Edgar Wright film, that it's not, okay, now Edgar's going to do these boring documentaries on the side. And then his real films are going to be these, you know, amazing, cool movies. But that wasn't the case, that we shares all of Edgar's kind of traits, cinematic traits within it too. And to do that in a documentary is pretty amazing, we think, because it's hard because, you know, there's so many things that a documentary just by nature has to be something, you know, something dealing with that subject matter. But Edgar was also able to take the subject matter, but also include his own stamp on it. And that we think is pretty amazing.
Are you guys missing anyone? I noticed that Morrissey was noticeably absent. He's a big fan of yours. And I feel like, you know, if David Bowie had been alive, I would love to hear what he would have to say about you guys, because I would assume he was simpatico and probably a big admirer. I don't know if anyone has any insight to that, but.
You guys met Bowie once, didn't you?
Yeah, we met him backstage at a concert, and he came up to us and he said, "Hey, it's good seeing you again." And we'd never met him before. So that was our encounter with Bowie.
We did meet his wife, though. His wife was his previous wife in London. And she was super, super nice. But that was our main experience with Bowie. Yeah.
I mean, in terms of Morrissey, I did have a short correspondence with him about him being in it. But in a weird way, the way it shook out with him not being in it is that I felt like, actually, because he's sort of a noted fan, it was actually quite good to sort of do a documentary with everybody else, you know, because it felt like the right time to sort of say that, like, sort of that Morrissey is not the only fan of Sparks. So a lot of the other people in the documentary, like Ron and Russell, have never met, like, or were aware that they were Sparks fans before they saw it. So it was kind of an eye-opener on a lot of levels. There's some people who are noted Sparks fans, like Bjork has certainly said that he was, you know, like, obsessed with Come On In My House, or, you know, Vince Clarke, and, you know, but, you know, there's a lot of people that, like, had never gone on record saying it, you know, so that was amazing for, like, to be able to show them the documentary, and there'd be a whole host of famous faces that they had never met was great.
Yeah, I didn't mention that because that was another just amazing thing, that all these people from various creative walks of life, you know, that Edgar had gotten to take part in this. And it was amazing. And like Edward said, we weren't aware of the vast majority of them having, you know, like, liking Sparks, let alone even knowing Sparks. So that when Edgar would say, "Oh, next week he's interviewing, for instance, you know, Mike Myers," we go, "Mike Myers, that's too cool. But does he know Sparks?" And, you know, and then you hear him reciting lyrics to "Girl from Germany." You kind of go, "Wow, that's amazing." And Neil Gaiman, also reciting lyrics to and showing and analyzing album cover artwork and all of that sort of stuff was just so so heartwarming for us to see.
This is a really big year for you guys, right? I mean, you've got this documentary is coming out, and then Annette, and then you did this single with Todd Rundgren, which is really bringing things back. It's like, this is the year of Sparks. It's like, I don't know how you guys planned it or how, you know, the releases of everything, but it's the year, it's your year.
You can tell in the documentary, our planning isn't very, very good. It never works out that way. So it's all, it's actually all perfect that, you know, there's, you know, 75 things going on now. And then, you know, when you want things to be spaced out, like in a nice orderly way, it never happens that way. So, but we're really, you know, happy. And Edgar too, it's just weird. Like, and he's got his a great upcoming film too. So it's just weird that two films by each of us upcoming too. So it's just, it's crazy, but yeah, we're excited about that, you know, and especially when you see in the documentary, specifically things about other eras where we had potential film projects and they just didn't pan out. So to now see that something like Annette has finally happened, a movie that we wrote, that had, you know, the initial story and done all the music and everything. And so it's kind of fulfilled our the past disappointments when we had really great projects that were there with really great directors, but they didn't materialize. So.
I was going to say the last bit of filming that we did was on the set of Annette. So that's in fact the last time I saw Ron Russell in person, I think. Unless it was my New Year's Eve party, Russell, I get confused. Annette was last, but what's interesting is when we started production on the documentary, I don't think Annette was 100% happening. And then like it was after I filmed Last Night in Soho, you then were filming and I came over to Brussels especially. So, you know, that was so great because it was like, you know, it was almost like a sort of an unfinished B plot in the movie. It's like, oh my God, Annette's happening. Great. It's like, fantastic. This B plot has a happy ending.
Yeah. Thank God you didn't have to say. And then the sad thing happened with their next movie not happening.
Another in a long line.
That would be a real bummer if that's how it panned out.
It's such a perfect narrative beat to tie all that stuff together with and then you've got this whole theme of cinema and stuff. I have to wrap up quickly, but I just wanted to ask you guys, because some of the musical collaborations that you almost did were sort of legendary even to me. So, and I'm a huge Jacques Tati fan, so I have to ask, was there a story to that? I think it was called Confusion, and it's a great what if of cinema to me, that you know, you and Jacques Tati were going to do something and it didn't happen. I'm sure even someone like Edgar would have loved to have seen that. Like, I mean, just like, can you imagine? So do you guys have any sense of what that would have been, or was it?
Yeah, we were supposed to be TV folks from America that were coming to a small provincial French town to help out, to give our know-how, your American, you know, television know-how to this really provincial French television station. And Tati worked for that station. And I was the director from America, and Ron was some executive who was coming over to help out. And that was the basic premise of the movie. And then everything else was a lot of, you know, we had seen initial, you know, storyboard and all, Tati having some, you know, really plotted out gag, you know, like situations, yeah, and stuff that were typical of his other films, really amazing stuff. And so Tati had thought, just he had thought that, you know, at that time, Sparks could help bring a new audience to his films too, that would see what he was doing in a different way. And I think that was part of the what he wanted to do. And he really, you know, we got along really well with him, and he was amazing. We met several times in Paris at the Hilton Hotel. I remember we'd always a lot of times end up meeting there. He would come dressed up exactly as Monsieur Hulot with his the trench coat and his hat. And he said he took the bus there. He likes observing people. So he would come taking the bus, and it was totally all true. You know, he was a real character, and the waitresses would come over and he'd kind of be staring at them like, you know, very Tati-esque, you know, and, you know, giving reactions to them. And so he was one and the same in our kind of dealings with him as his character. He was amazing.
The one thing that remains from that, of course, is the song Confusion, which is on the Indiscreet Sessions, which is like that's the only sort of thing that survived in a way.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe an existing screenplay somewhere.
There's one that we've seen floating around. There's some big Toshin collection, book collection that has elements from in it. Yeah. So, but it kind of started morphing later on. It's got a really weird history, the whole film, but we were in there kind of early on and stuff.
Cool. Well, I could keep going and ask you a million questions, but I have to go. And I just want to say, I really love this documentary. It's fantastic. You guys are amazing. Best of luck to everything with it, because it's just so good. And it's just awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye. Thanks for your review as well. It was so great. Oh, really appreciate
thanks.
It.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I genuinely love the doc. It's really fantastic. I think I've seen it like three times now.
Oh, great. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, guys. Take care.
Bye.
Okay, that's it for me. Thank you for tuning in to the very, semi-irregularly scheduled Deep Focus podcast. I kind of do it, you know, sporadically here and there. But, you know, this week you're going to hear from me three times in total. You've just listened to hopefully all of this Edgar Wright and Sparks conversation. Hopefully you enjoyed it. And on deck, we have conversations with Hannah Fidel. She's the writer and director and creator of A Teacher on FX. That's coming up. And I'm also going to have a conversation with the great legendary filmmaker Abel Ferrara. I actually did not conduct that interview myself, but I am going to tee it up and tell you all about it. I think that's going to be really, really amazing too. I wish I could have done that one myself. I couldn't, but yes, you know, Abel Ferrara is one of the greatest. Again, The Sparks Brothers comes out Friday, June 18th. Make sure to catch it. This documentary is fabulous. As always, my Deep Focus podcast is part of the Playlist Podcast Network. Includes Be Real, Playlist Podcast, that is a weekly podcast, The Discourse, The Fourth Wall, and more. You can hear us on iTunes, Anchor FM, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. Wherever you get your podcasts, that's where we're at. If you see us someplace that we're not, let us know. We'll join. You know, do us a big favor. Rate, subscribe, drop us a comment. Do us all that stuff. You know, do us that big favor if you can. We really appreciate it. If you sat through this whole entire long conversation and this, however long this is going to be, 40 something minutes, I don't know. I love you. Thank you. we'll talk to you soon, and hopefully you'll be listening to at least two more podcasts this week. You know, the Playlist podcast itself, the one that Charles Barfield, our managing editor, does, he's got a bunch this week too. We've got a massive amount of podcasts this weekend. It's all sort of hitting at once. Okay, rock on. Thanks again. Bye. Stop!